Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour number two. Glad to have you with us. My name is David Inge. The producers for the program here, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal. In this hour, we're going to the archives for a program that we first aired in January of last year, 2005. So as you listen, do keep in mind that in this hour of the show, we will not take calls. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be looking back to an event that was a key event in the long struggle for civil rights here in the United States. Key in the sense that it grabbed national attention and energized, galvanized a lot of people who would then go on to become very much involved in the movement. And we're talking about the death of Emmett Till. In the summer of 1955, Emmett Till was kidnapped in the middle of the night and brutally murdered by two white men, most probably with the involvement of others. His crime was that he allegedly whistled at a white woman. He was just 14 years old. This morning, we'll be talking with Christopher Benson. He's a journalist, makes his home in Chicago. He's also a lawyer. He's a feature editor for Ebony, former Washington editor for both Ebony and Jet. He's contributed articles to the publications Chicago and Reader's Digest. And he is the author, really the co-author, of a book entitled Death of Innocence, The Story of the Hate Crime That Changed America. And it is a memoir by Emmett Till's mom, Mamie Till Mobley, about her experiences with her son, about what the death meant to her, and about what happened afterwards. The book's published by Random House. It came out a couple of years ago. And we're pleased to have Christopher Benson here with us this morning to talk about it. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, David. It's a pleasure.
How did you meet, come to know Mamie Till Mobley?
We were introduced by a mutual friend. David Barr is a celebrated playwright in Chicago who had worked with her on a dramatization of her story, at least one aspect of it, the trial. And I had always wanted to meet her. I had done a story about the play for Chicago Magazine. So we went by one night, started talking, and at one point in this conversation, she just blurted out, you know, I've always wanted to write a book. Well, my friend, knowing that I had written a novel already, said, well, maybe you want to talk to this guy. I mean, he writes books, and maybe you guys can work it out. That was in June 2002, and by July, we were working full speed ahead on documenting her story, and within 6 months, she was dead. So this was the last 6 months of her life. Devoted to doing the one thing that she had wanted to do for the nearly 50 years since Emmett's death.
Yeah. Apparently, there had been other attempts, or she had talked with other people along the way, and she must have had this very strong desire to tell this story, and perhaps also felt that now was the time to do it. There was some sense of urgency, perhaps, her feeling that if she didn't do it, it wouldn't get done.
Absolutely, she was 80 when we met, 81 when she died. She was in poor health, and she had to know that she was approaching the end of her life. So I always felt there was this tension that existed in her, that she had held so much of her story and that she ran the risk of taking it with her. And what a great tragedy that would have been, that we would have been denied this beautiful story, really. It's mm-hmm. in the end, spiritually uplifting, even though it has some really, really painful parts. So, yeah, she had to have that feeling. She had many disappointments along the way. Had started talking to people about writing a book, actually had a book contract at one point. The co-author never produced. So, you know, it's in some ways a miracle that she trusted me enough with the story to sit down and talk to me and take this one last chance to get it done. Hmm.
At the time that this happened, she and her son were living in Chicago. Yes. And she apparently decided to send him down to Mississippi, where there was family, to visit relatives, and put him on the train, the City of New Orleans train, and sent him down there. And that is where it was that he died. Can we talk about the event itself? And I guess we acknowledge the fact that different people have told different stories about what happened.
Right.
What do you think happened? Or can we really say for certain what happened?
I think more certainty has grown over time. But, you know, it's interesting. You know, a lot of the people who are telling stories are from Mississippi, and stories in Mississippi grow like the cotton. I looked at documents early on. I looked at reports early on about what was testified at trial in order to talk to her and conduct the interviews. And it's amazing to me how some of the stories have developed from that point. Three basic stories have emerged about the event that took place at the Bryant store, where Emmett and his friends and cousins visited one evening. There was a whistle. That part is established, a wolf whistle. And one person has said that Emmett saw a very impressive checker move on the porch outside the store and whistled at that checker move. His cousins have said that he whistled at a white woman, the proprietor of the store, Carolyn Bryant, as a prank, never understanding, never fully appreciating what that would have meant in the Mississippi Delta in 1955. And the final version is the one that Mamie Till Mobley believed and carried to her grave, and that was that it was something she had taught him to do. He had a terrible stutter. Emmett had suffered polio when he was about 6 years old, had recovered at least to the extent that he could control the muscles in his legs, but his vocal cords were damaged. He had a terrible stutter. And one of the many things she taught him in order to overcome that was to whistle, to steady his voice, to control his breathing, and then to go on to talk. And bubblegum, which is what he was asking the woman for at the time, is one of the words that he would have gotten stuck on. And she believed, as one of his cousins did mention, you know, this whistle that when he talked, she believed all along that that's what happened. And it created a great deal of anxiety, as you might imagine, for a mother to have believed for the rest of her life that the one thing she taught him, thinking that she was helping him to enjoy a better life, may in the end have cost him his life.
Mm-hmm. One of the things when she put him on the train to go visit his relatives, she knew from having grown up there what the atmosphere was like and what relations were between black and white and how difficult and dangerous that could be. That was something that he had not experienced. What did she tell him to try to prepare him for what that would be like when she put him on the train to go to Mississippi?
Mm. Well, there was something of a drill that all parents took their kids through, black parents took their kids through when they sent them south for vacations. This was like summer camp for black kids in the north. She actually didn't grow up in Mississippi. She was born there, but her family left early on in her life. But Mississippi was always a part of their culture in the Chicago area. So she did have some understanding, and she did take him through the drill. You know, you always say, yes, sir. You always say, yes, ma'am. No, sir. No, ma'am. If a white person approaches you on the street as you are walking, you step off the sidewalk and let them pass. You don't look white people in the eye. You don't say anything unless you're spoken to, and always remember, yes, sir, no, sir. Well, this was quite a new thing for Emmett. I mean, as you see in the book, he is quite an extraordinary kid in his mother's account and in the account of all the friends of his I talked to. A natural-born leader, extremely confident. He was an only child, so you can imagine a certain amount of pampering. He was the center of everybody's universe, and I don't think he fully appreciated the difference. And as Mother Mobley expresses in the book, I mean, how do you give a crash course in hatred to a child who's known only love all his life, and has all of the elements that would have put him at risk down in Mississippi, that sense of pride and confidence that you know, white racists wanted to snuff out.
So what do we know about what happened on that night when he was kidnapped and killed?
Well, first there was the whistle. That was on a Wednesday night. He had only arrived in the Mississippi Delta on Saturday. So from Saturday to Wednesday, you know, they're out picking cotton in the day, you know, doing their recreation at night. They go uptown to the store. That's where the whistle occurred. 3 days later, Saturday night into Sunday morning, it was 2:00 in the morning, two white men came to the door of his great uncle's house, the place where he was staying, and demanded, you know, that his great uncle produce him. They had heard something about what had happened, and they wanted to take him to find out if he was the boy who had done whatever they had heard was done. It was a moment of terror in the house. It's 2:30 in the morning. The lights are out. There was some problem with the electricity at the time. So the only light was coming from a flashlight that one of these men was holding. In one hand, he had the flashlight. In another hand, he had a gun. It was clear this was not a good thing. And the great uncle was surprised by the visit, first of all, and didn't know exactly what to do. The men said they wanted to talk to this boy. If he was not the right one, they'd bring him back. One of the men was Roy Bryant, the husband of Carolyn, and the other was J.W. Milam, the half-brother of Roy. So they grabbed Emmett, they took him out of bed, took him out to the truck that they had driven, and the great uncle testified later in court that he heard a voice saying, yes, that's the one, and it was a woman's voice. There was also a black man who was present who took Emmett into the back of the truck and held him as they drove away, and they never saw him alive again. Hmm. He was found. His body was found 3 days later. It had been weighted down in the Tallahatchie River by a 75-pound gin fan that was tied around his neck with barbed wire. And a knee had floated to the top of the water, and he was discovered by a boy who was fishing. And that's how it transpired. Now, this story really would have ended there. I mean, so many lynchings in the South ended quietly in that way, locally, except that his mother was determined that this would not end there. They were supposed to bury his body immediately in Mississippi. That was the sheriff's orders. They wanted to cover this thing up. And she insisted that his body be returned to Chicago. They moved heaven and earth in order to have that happen. They only returned his body in a locked box bearing the seal of the state of Mississippi under orders that the box not be open. And she said, no, I'm going to take one last look at my son. And she proceeded to identify her son, the horribly mutilated body that had been returned to her. And the final critical decision she made was to have an open casket funeral. And that's where everything started. And that's what sets this brutal murder apart from so many others that had occurred in the South, because 100,000 people in Chicago filed by Emmett's casket and were so moved by what they saw that, as you mentioned in the opening, they became active. They became active in the movement and determined to stop this horrible thing that had been occurring in our country, this system of American apartheid.
Well, I should take a moment here to introduce again our guest, and then we have a caller we will get to. We're talking this morning with Christopher Benson. He is a Chicago-based writer and also lawyer. He is the author, along with Mamie Till Mobley, of the book Death of Innocence, The Story of the Hate Crime That Changed America, published by Random House. Came out in 2003?
Yes.
Is that right? Is this now in paper?
Yeah, the paperback has just been released, so.
Here on the program, if you're interested in calling in, if you have questions, comments, you can do that. 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana listeners. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We do have a caller, someone in Chicago. So we'll go right there for our first call. Line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
I have two questions, but it's one. But is it true that when the reporters came down to cover this trial, there were a handful of African-American reporters, and the people of Mississippi didn't believe they were reporters? That was one. And is it true that the reporters from the North were told, at night, it might be a good idea for you to stay in town and don't wander off? You might be co-victim yourself.
Yes to part two. I'm not sure about part one. I know it was terribly – well, first of all, this was a huge media event, the coverage of the murder trial. Roughly 100 reporters descended on this tiny town where the trial was taking place. The white media, the mass media, and about 12 black reporters and photographers. And you're right, they all stayed in a local black enclave, Mound Bayou. It was all black town, and they pretty much stayed put during the evening because it was treacherous. All reporters were subject to a certain amount of hostility there because there was an attempt in the local community to circle the wagons. There was a sense in Mississippi that this was the whole country coming down on them. So it was treacherous for a number of reporters. But
well,
more to the point, the black reporters and the white reporters were told not to intermingle. They were going to enforce segregation even to that point. So the white reporters sat at the press table. The black reporters sat at a makeshift Jim Crow table in court.
Yeah, I had heard that they were told it might not be a good idea for them to walk around, even though Reportedly, the Northern reporters said that they didn't like it. They did it anyway, which, yes, shows a certain amount of hypocritical behavior, although I guess I couldn't blame them. But I understood that they were, all the reporters were told that it might be a good idea to stay in town at night, not to wander off because you might be have a health risk.
Yeah, and you know, you're right, too, about the fact that they didn't really obey that order, because reporters being reporters, they want to get the story. And, you know, this was the first time that you put a human face on this terrible race problem that we were experiencing in the country. And the reporters who covered it, white and black, were so moved by the story that they wanted to make sure that they got everything down, because they wanted to file their reports as accurately as possible. So there was some, there were some secret meetings among black and white reporters where they were comparing notes and getting a lot more involved in the investigation. It's a fascinating story that comes out in the book about how they participated in the investigation and helped to bring forward some surprise witnesses.
Well, you know, I was surprised when 25 years later, then Kennedy Reagan stood up and said, at the time we didn't even know there was a race problem. I'm sure that Rosa Parks knew there was one, and I know Emmett Till's mother knew there was one. And is it true that there was that the black man that you mentioned that helped these guys, he left Mississippi, went to Chicago, thought about it, and had a nervous breakdown?
That actually was one of the surprise witnesses. He had gone into hiding, and he was located through the joint efforts of black reporters, NAACP activists, including Medgar Evers, and some of the local authorities who were more sympathetic. And they found this person and brought him forward. And after his testimony, where he identified the two killers, he had to be spirited out of Mississippi, of course, and he went to Chicago, where he did have a nervous breakdown. He still lives in the Chicago area, and I was able to talk to him during the course of writing this book, and he's never fully recovered from that experience.
Yeah, I understand that these two guys did confess after the trial.
Absolutely, which is why I call them killers. I mean, after they were acquitted, and I guess I should cover that part of the story, after 4 days of testimony, the jury deliberated for just a little more than an hour. And they said they only took that long because they were trying to make it look good. So they had a coke break and stretched it out. They came back with an acquittal. And within a month, an interview was conducted with Look magazine. The article was published in February 1956. And they confessed in great detail about how they killed Emmett and why. They killed him because they felt they needed to send a message to the black community that this kind of confidence was not going to be tolerated in black people, that you had to stay in your place. We were not going to tolerate you stepping over the line. So this was in every way a lynching, the way lynching is defined.
I guess so. You know, it's hard for those of us who, well, I was a small boy then, but I grew up in the North, but it's hard for us to realize how ingrained racism was when a white guy can walk up to a woman and say, get up and let me sit down. Two men can come to a house at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, give us the boy.
And not only that, know when they do that they can get away with murder.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Thanks a lot.
All right, well, thanks for the call. Other people who are listening are certainly welcome if you have questions. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, as you mentioned, the two men were charged, they were tried, they were acquitted, and also, as you mentioned, then later afterwards, they indeed confessed. They said, yes, they did it. It is, the belief of everyone who has looked at this that there were other people involved. And I think recently, particularly because of books like yours and a documentary that was made, it has caused a lot of people to say, well, perhaps we should, the investigation here, this whole case should be reopened, and we should find out, were indeed other people responsible? Can they still be held accountable? Can you talk a little bit about where that stands right at the moment?
Well, on May 10th, 2004, the Justice Department did announce that it was opening an investigation into this murder. What it means basically for them is, since there's no federal jurisdiction, is that they're assisting the state in a murder investigation. What we discuss in the book is based on information that Mother Mobley had at the time of the trial and then on after talking to other people, that we estimate at least seven people were involved. Keith Beauchamp, the documentarian who pushed really hard to get the federal government involved and successfully persuaded them to do that with evidence he found, Started out suggesting there were 10, and now I think he's up to 12, maybe even 15 people. We'll see how that pans out. What we based our number on was the testimony of people at the time that there were at least four white people seen or heard and two to three blacks. And one of the white people, we believe, is Carolyn Bryant, who was there at least at the identification of Emmett and may have been involved in some other point as well. The two blacks we've been able to identify were working for J.W. Milam and Roy Bryant and may have been there under some duress. We just don't know. The status of the investigation, as I understand it at this point, is that they're getting close to perhaps issuing some indictments. The statute of limitations does not run on murder. You do the crime, you're going to do the time at some point in your life. And I think it's a good thing that the investigation was open because, if nothing else, it sends a message that I think is an important message at this point in our history, that you cannot get away with murder in this country. That if you commit a hate crime in particular, it doesn't matter how long it takes, you're going to be made to answer for that. And it doesn't matter if you're old, if you're infirm, if you've done something as horrific as what was done to this kid, you're going to have to pay for it. And I think now there are a number of people who are very nervous about whether somebody's going to come knocking on their door.
As you mentioned, when Emmett Till was killed, the authorities there in Mississippi, what if they had their way, he would have been buried there and they would have been done everything that they possibly could to make sure that the story ended there and that it was because of the strength and the tenacity of his mother that that didn't happen, that his body came back to Chicago. And then, as you say, it was in a locked box. And she said, no, I'm not going to take that either. I at least want to see him one last time. And she had the box, the coffin, opened. And it was very obvious just how he had been brutalized. And then there was the decision made, and I assume that indeed this was her decision, to have a service with an open coffin so everybody could see. She wanted everybody to know what had happened. And it was an enormous event. A great number of people came and attended this. Can you talk a little bit about what that event, his funeral, really meant and how people reacted to it at the time?
Well, this was a transforming moment, first of all, for Mamie Mobley. She was a person who was not politically active. In fact, she felt no connection to the fledgling civil rights movement. In her view, you know, the movement came down to black folks moving out of the South. I mean, you know, once you moved north, all your problems were over. She found that the worst part of race hatred was delivered right to her doorstep. And in an instant, she was transformed. So she began speaking in ways that she had never expressed before. She was politicized by this. I mean, she was brokenhearted. It was the worst tragedy any parent could experience. But she was transformed by it. And she mined her grief for a mission in life, and that was to make sure that this never happened again and that people understood that we all had to take responsibility for the horrible system that had developed in this country, the system of separation, of American apartheid. So in an instant, she decided that everybody needed to see Emmett's body. And she ordered that he have an open casket. Early on, it was clear that there were too many people lined up to view the body at the funeral to accommodate them in that one day. So she decided, rather than to bury him on the day of the funeral, that she would let him lie in state for 4 days. And over the course of that 4 days, the lines never seemed to diminish. And the estimates were that about 100,000 people filed by his casket and viewed his body. The Reverend Jesse Jackson has described that as the largest civil rights demonstration up to that point, because what you see, on the faces of the people who are lined up in particular is this determination, this resolve that they are also drawing the line. It's a moment of transformation for them as well. And I've talked to so many people who either viewed his body or saw a picture that was published in Jet magazine of his mutilated face. And they said that at that moment, they identified with him, people who were about his age at the time, who came of age during the peak of the civil rights movement who felt that they had to be involved because they did not want this kind of thing to ever happen again. And if there were people who could put their lives on the line, like Rosa Parks, like Mamie Till Mobley, in these acts of courage that inspired so many people, if they could do that, then certainly I can do that as well. And that's why people say that it helped to galvanize that feeling. You know, we're in a period of looking at so many civil rights milestones, Brown versus Board of Education, the Montgomery bus boycott. The murder of Emmett Till really lies at the center of all of that because it gave people the impetus, it gave people the motivation to get out there and press for the rights that had been established in Brown and the tactic that had been established in the Montgomery bus boycott.
We're just a little bit past the midpoint here, and I have a caller where we'll get right to. But again, I'd just like to introduce again the guest, Christopher Benson. He's a Chicago-based writer and lawyer. He is the author, along with Mamie Till Mobley, Emmett Till's mother, of the book Death of Innocence, The Story of the Hate Crime That Changed America, published by Random House. It is just out in paper now if you want to read the book. Questions are welcome, too, here in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's someone to talk with in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes. I'm just curious. This is a general question. I want to make a brief elaborating comment as well. This case and what's happened with this case, I'm wondering what you think this really reveals about the problem of racism in American society then and now. Something that comes to mind is I recently saw an Australian film called, I think, The Rabbit Fence, that was about the displacement of children who were the product of quote-unquote miscegenation, you know. Of course, I saw the Emmett Till documentary many months ago and also the recent Jack Johnson boxing documentary. What I'm wondering is, you know, I used to think that, you know, Australia, for example, I had an image in my own mind of it being a terribly racist society. I always thought of America as, you know, we'd made all these strides in the 60s and so on. But I really wonder, do you really feel that there has been a national catharsis in this country? I mean, when we think about red states and blue states, more recently, for example, even in the 1960s, it was the Voting Rights Act in which, you know, the Democrats finally turned, right, in a progressive direction. And it was only as of then, of course, that the South went Republican. And this obviously is not to accuse all Republicans of being racist, but it's clearly the case that there is a very strong contingent of, people in the South, as well as other areas, who have a problem with race. Even Champaign-Urbana then and now, there is clearly, undoubtedly, a problem with race. This was an area apparently not segregated in the restaurants and in the movie houses until the 1960s, which is unbelievable to me, but quite incredible. And a strong, of course, you know, sort of conservative contingent in this area as well, in this part of the state, even in a blue state. I just wonder what you think this suggests about American society more generally. Do we simply have this ongoing racial problem that we've swept under the rug in many ways, and the fact that Emmett Till's case is really never, you know, they've never done anything legally in this context sufficiently to address it, that it suggests that we still have a terrible problem?
Well, yes, I agree with you. We had a terrible problem, certainly, in the period leading up to Emmett's murder, a period of institutionalized racism, of imposed separation. I think there's a feeling now that we've overcome all of that because the institutions of racism have been abolished by law. But we still are dealing with problems. I mean, we have the lasting effects of this long period of slavery and Jim Crow that people don't recognize. And I think that one of the tragically ironic byproducts of the civil rights movement is that feeling that now that the laws were enacted, instantly everything changed and everything's good and we don't have a problem. So what is all the complaining about? I think in quiet ways it exists. It exists when I talk to professionals who, black professionals who say they encounter problems in the workplace. I think it certainly exists in in much louder ways in the cases of mysterious deaths that we see of black men in Mississippi, men who are found hanged from trees and where officials rule them as these deaths as suicides.
This is today?
This is today, yes.
Yeah.
We talk about one of those cases in the book, a case of a young boy in Mississippi who, 17 years old, was found hanging from a tree in his front yard by a belt. And the death was ruled a suicide. He had been friends with a white girl, and there had been some tension about that in his local community in Kokomo. And his parents argued that the belt didn't even come from his closet and that his feet were touching the ground, and they argued that he had been killed somewhere else and left there symbolically to send a message. And the officials never reversed their ruling that it was suicide. And there have been a number of those cases. Someone mentioned, Keith Beauchamp mentioned at his screening last night, that he has seen evidence of 79 lynchings in Mississippi. The problem is that they're not being classified as hate crimes. So it's difficult for us to measure this. But you have to consider, you know, if a black man is going to commit suicide, is he going to do it in this way, knowing all the history of lynching in the South? It's right. Unlikely. But more to the point, there's evidence of wrongdoing that people are ignoring. So, yeah, we're still facing a problem on both those levels, in the quiet ways and the not-so-quiet ways. The Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors these matters, is tracking right now 700 hate groups in this country. This is a group that basically busted the Ku Klux Klan and drove them into bankruptcy, but now we see these splinter groups all over the country, and that establishes the problem that we're dealing with. And we're also dealing with the problem of education, and we're hoping that stories like this story, the efforts by the documentarians and so many other efforts to educate the public will pay off, because people need to realize that we still have a lot of work to do in this country.
Well, I really applaud what you're doing, and you know, seeing these documentaries and so on as well. The worry I always have is that documentaries such as the Ken Burns documentary and so on, Jack Johnson and that sort of thing, that we pat ourselves on the back and say, ah, you know, it's good we're not like that anymore. And it's frightening, actually, this kind of notion, because, you know, I know that I read, I think it was in the New York Times, a study that was done a couple of years ago in which they, you know, did a poll of people, I think in Louisiana, Mississippi, and I believe Alabama, and roughly 50% or more of the population said that miscegenation, that is the contact between male and females of different races, should be illegal. And I read that and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, this is the, you know, the late 20th, early 21st century, and we have a tremendous problem. And until we stop patting ourselves on the back and only celebrating Martin Luther King Day and start paying attention to these problems and problems like the chief in our own town, which is another issue, we're not going to get anywhere, frankly. And I really, again, applaud your work and thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. Yeah.
Well, let's go on. We have another caller. This is also someone listening in Champaign on line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just have a comment. I heard the documentary where Mother Mobley spoke, and she was so poised and articulate. She was very impressive.
Well, our guest here actually met her face to face, so I suppose he'd be in a position to say what his personal impression of her was when she was saying.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I spent so much time with her during that last 6 months of her life. Poised, articulate, I think a brilliant woman, a spiritual woman who harbored no bitterness at all, which is the really surprising thing that you discovered about her. When I met her, she seemed to have an aura that surrounded her that that warmed you just to be in her presence, and she drew people to her. And I saw it over and over and over again at the public events that I attended with her. It really was a special quality that she had, and you can understand why she was able to move so many people with her very presence.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Again, other people who are listening, if you'd like to call in, we have about 20 minutes. If you'd like to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about what what had happened, what apparently people had said had happened when Emmett Till went into this store. And the story being that he had whistled at the white woman who was working there in the store. And you explained also the fact that he had had this really terrible stutter, and his mother had taught him this little trick of whistling before he was coming up to say a difficult word. And she felt that maybe somehow, in some way, that she was responsible for what had happened. And I'm sure probably she also thought back to that moment and all of the things that she had told him to try to prepare him for going there, and no doubt thought, could I have done something? Could I have told him something? Was there anything that possibly I could do to prevent this from happening? Was that something that even at the time that you knew her and you were talking to her, she was still wrestling with?
Yes. And, you know, the really amazing and painful part of this for me was to get her to open up. It was my responsibility as her co-author to make sure that she didn't hold back, but it also was the pain that I had to bear, because in pulling her out, I had to absorb everything that she was saying in order to help her present it. And I had this moment with her when I knew that we had crossed the line. She was used to telling parts of this story, but she did it in almost a detached way. It was almost a way of putting off the interviewer by describing some of the horrors that she had seen. But she did it in an almost clinical, mechanical way. And what I tried to do is to get her to open up. And I felt that I had accomplished that at a certain point. But then this one moment we had on the anniversary of Emmett's murder, when she expressed to me her feeling about what had happened at that barn where Emmett was beaten to death. And she said, you know, there was a point, you know, in the course of those 2 hours when I know he called out two names, God and Mama, and nobody was there to answer the call. And what a chilling expression of a mother's feeling that is. She went on to say that, I only hope he died quickly. Well, what that told me was that she felt that responsibility, you know, for all those reasons. One, if she, you know, believed that something he did was something she taught him to do when he was under stress, then she would feel the responsibility for that. If she felt that she sent him down there without the adequate preparation, then she would feel some responsibility for that. Just sending him down there at all was something she had to feel responsibility for. And the other side of this pain, was what she expressed to me late in our process, in December, just weeks before her death, that this experience for her had been cathartic, that she had sorted so many things in the course of telling her story to me and the probing questions that I would ask, that, you know, I knew at that moment she had found forgiveness for herself.
Hmm. As a journalist, I'm sure moments like that, you have to at some level think that person that you were talking to had given you a great gift in opening up to you emotionally to that degree, and you would have to appreciate the fact that they would have the kind of trust and that you had built that kind of relationship with the person that they could feel that they could do that. On the other hand, I'm sure that emotionally it was for you a wrenching kind of a moment. When that happened, did you say anything? Did you just sit and just absorb it? Did you have this feeling as if you would have wanted to say something and yet felt you couldn't, or it just wouldn't be appropriate?
At that moment, I didn't. I thought that the best thing for me to do was to listen to her, not to break that mood, because she clearly had reached a point, and it took a while, mm-hmm, for us to reach the point where she had that kind of trust in me, and something you earn, obviously, by showing that you can understand, that you can empathize. But at that moment, no, I just wanted her to talk, and that's clearly all she wanted to do. There was a point later on where I did have a private comment. I wasn't taking notes at this moment, by the way. I was just listening to her. There was a point later on when, as we were breaking up after one of our interviews, when I turned to her and I said, you know, you said at one point that nobody was there to answer the call, but you have been there. You've answered the call in everything that you've done throughout your life, in teaching people, in helping people, in finding that extraordinary gift that you found in so many students you taught in the 23 years that you were a Chicago school teacher. And that meant something to her. And so that was my response. It was a delayed response, but I thought it better not to, you know, to interfere with her expression of this great pain. But I absorbed it. Yeah. There's no question about it.
Well, again, we have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Christopher Benson. He's a Chicago-based writer and lawyer. He has written for both Ebony and Jet magazines. He's also contributed to articles to Chicago and to Reader's Digest. He's the author of a novel. He's also the author of this book that he wrote together with Mamie Till Mobley, titled Death of Innocence, The Story of the Hate Crime That Changed America. It's published by Random House. It is now out in paper. Again, this is sort of a question to for the journalist part of you. Her, you were helping her to tell her story, and in many, many ways, Death of Innocence is her book. Her name comes first on the book, probably as it should. I'm sure, though, that as a journalist, you have certain impulses about how you feel the story should be told and what should be there. How did you balance your journalistic instincts, your feelings about, well, this is the way we should tell the story and this is what should be there, with the fact that you were helping her to tell her story and this really was her story?
When she first expressed to me that she wanted to write a book, it took me all of a split second to decide that this would be the most important thing I would ever do in my life. So I was ready to do it. My only reservation was that, one, I knew she was an incredibly strong woman and had been a school teacher, and we know how we feel about school teachers. I felt that she was going to have a very strong view about the way this book was going to be told. And as a writer, as a journalist, I would have a very strong view as well. And I was concerned about how we'd be able to harmonize those views. She said early on, she said she could go back to when she was 3 years old in her recollection. I'm thinking, okay, well, that's good, but I think people are going to want to get to Emmett right away. And so what I do before I'd come by to interview her, I tell her ahead of time what I wanted to lead off with so she could think about it a little bit. And in our first meeting, I said, you know, I just want you to think about the thing you remember most about Emmett. And she was ready for that when we sat down, and she talked about what had been a very troubled birth. And that set the stage for this whole notion of the mother's angst that plays out in the arc of the story. As it turns out, that's exactly where I wanted to begin the story. So as she started telling that, you know, I said I wanted to start with Emmett. She starts with Emmett and his birth, a troubled birth, which sets the theme for the whole story. I realized that we were connecting. And I knew there was going to be no problem at all. And she's such a gifted storyteller that, you know, her words really resonate. So at a certain point, I'm putting together the chapters and sharing them with her. I sort, you know, she might tell a story that's linear and I'll split it up, you know, because the setup should start at one point, the payoff at a point when you know more about the story. And as I share that with her, you know, she had nothing to say about changes at all. So I knew we had connected. I knew there was going to be no problem. Clearly it's her story. It's told in her voice. But I helped her to organize. I helped to flesh out things in the questions and in the presentation and in the research. And she accepted that. She's a very giving woman. And you can see I still talk about her in the present tense. I mean, I still live with her in so many ways. But there was no problem at all in that. And I did anticipate a big problem. So I'm thankful that we were able to work so closely together on this.
Let's talk with someone else who was listening in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'd like you to go a little bit further, if you could, on the present-day situation that was referred to earlier, where there were, I believe you said, 700 hate groups. And I think it's important to point out what the situation is now, because, as the earlier caller said, it's so easy to say, well, back in the 1950s, these things occurred, but they don't happen anymore. Could you go a little bit further into the hate groups and the number of people involved in them and the current activities that have been disclosed about them?
Well, it's kind of hard to get people to release all this information. You know, when I talked to the people at the Southern Poverty Law Center, you know, they didn't want to give up precise numbers. You can understand that because in their investigation, they don't want to tip off people about how close they are. The FBI, they contend, doesn't really have accurate figures at all. But the you know, the nature of the groups is basically what you might expect. The white supremacist groups who come up in all kinds of incarnations, they preach hatred not just toward blacks but toward gays, you know, and Jews. And you know, and they preach you know, violent tactics. I mean, they want to enforce their white supremacy with through violence. So, I mean, that's in a nutshell. The events that unfold are subject to conjecture, simply because, as I say, you know, there's a problem with the way these their actions are being classified.
Have there been any like you said that they had driven the Klan out of business through legal actions and bankruptcy? Have there been any other groups that have gotten to that point where they have disclosed the information and been able to effectively shut them down?
Well, in a sense, by decapitating them. You know, the Morris Dees, the lead counsel at the Southern Poverty Law Center, has dedicated his life to going after these groups, mostly by targeting the leadership. So, yeah, there have been cases where he's been able to take out leaders of the groups through litigation. But then, of course, their following, you know, springs up somewhere else in some other incarnation. So it's an ongoing struggle. There's no question about it. Someone told me that some of the deaths in Mississippi may be tied to some cult-like initiation among white hate groups in Mississippi, you know, where you earn your credits as a member of the group by lynching a black person. I don't know if that's true, but that is the belief there. And that's an interesting thing. People talk about how far we've come and how far we have yet to go. You consider that the black community in Mississippi sees these deaths one way. The white community in Mississippi sees them another way. Just that alone tells us how far we have to go, that there is that divergent view based on experience that we still need to reconcile.
Very good. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. We're coming down to the point here. We have maybe 3-4 minutes left. And I want to, again, come back, bring it back to Emmett Till and about this event that we've talked about and that your book and his mother's book concentrates on. And I guess I'm, again, going back to the comment you mentioned that Jesse Jackson said something to the effect that this his death and his funeral was the perhaps really the first big event in the civil rights movement. And whether you can help us understand how this hit people in this country at the time. All right, you talked about so many people having attended the funeral and having viewed his body, and that maybe was the thing that spurred them to become an activist in the movement. But in a broader sort of a sense, how did this strike Americans? And was there a sort of resonance that was felt elsewhere in America, not simply in Chicago or in Mississippi?
Well, there were 5,000 or more documented lynchings in the South after Reconstruction. Emmett Till was the only name anybody ever knew. And that's a credit to the courage and the resolve of his mother and her willingness to expose this to the world. So to that extent, it had resonance throughout the country, throughout the world. When his killers were acquitted, there were protests throughout this country and even over in Europe. Josephine Baker led a demonstration in Paris, for example. But yes, it hit the white community as well, because this, as David Halberstam, one of the young reporters who covered the trial, would say, this was the murder trial was the first big media event of the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. So in a way, as we're entering the television age, suddenly you have this huge story that's growing up with television that is a very human story that touches the reporters who are covering it to the point where they become dedicated to bringing these stories into our living rooms every night. And you know the visuals. I mean, you've seen them. You see how the story plays out. But yes, it hit everybody. Black people throughout the country had some working awareness of the fact that there were ongoing lynchings because the black newspapers carried reports. The larger community had no awareness of that. So this opened everybody's eyes. And as one newspaper put it and got it exactly right, Mother Mobley opened the casket and opened our eyes.
Hmm. Well, we'll try very quick to get one more caller in here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to know if you had any advice for someone who wanted to continue the direction that we've taken, and that is to try to bring different ethnicities and different peoples together. It doesn't seem that someone who, I don't know if you want to say is in the majority, I'm a white guy, and I'm wondering what ways can I be active and involved other than to just teach my children and to try to spread that.
I'll give you about a minute to respond to that.
I think it's encouraging that you even want to do it. Yes, you're the majority, not only numerically, but as a matter of power. And I think it's important to understand that race in America has been a white problem more than anything else, because you do have the power. I think the dialogue that we're trying to start up again is a very important thing. I think for you to reach that level of awareness that you can pass on to your kids, I think is vitally important so that they grow up with an attitude of tolerance, of acceptance, and work in every way they can to help to bring us together.
We will have to stop there. For people who want to read the story, I'll mention again that the book, Death of Innocence, The Story of the Hate Crime That Changed America, is available. It's now published in paper by Mamie Till Mobley and our guest, Christopher Benson. So if you're interested in reading the book, you can seek it out. Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure to be here. Thank you, Dave.